This is Pastor Mike Fabares with Focal Point Ministries. I trust that the following recorded sermon will be a benefit and a challenge to your walk with Christ. For more information about Focal Point Ministries, log on to focalpointradio.org or call us toll-free at 888-320-5885.
Would you not agree that the disciples were sure a privileged group of people? Can you imagine being one of the 12 apostles? If you have a Bible, turn to Mark chapter 10 and think about how incredible it must have been to have on your resume that you were personally discipled by Jesus Christ himself. Think about that one. Front row seats to every sermon he ever preached. Freedom to ask him any question you had about theology or life or what you should do in a relationship. Think about that. You got Christ every day, 3 years, day in and day out. Incredible privilege, incredible access. But with all that privilege and all that access and what you would hope would be all that maturity that would flow from that kind of access to God himself, some of the questions that they did actually ask Christ may surprise you just a little bit. Look at this passage in Mark chapter 10. Drop your eyes down to verse 35 and see what two of the 12 apostles came asking Jesus one day. James and John, sons of Zebedee, came to him and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." That's setting him up, isn't it? "Would you do for me whatever I'm about to ask you?" Jesus, smart man, says, "Well, you know, what is it exactly that you'd like me to do?" They replied, "Well, you know, if it wouldn't be too big of a deal, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." Okay. Now, if you're a Jew in that day, and even today, if you think through Scripture clearly, you understand that Christ is one day going to sit on a throne in Jerusalem, ruling not only Israel, but the entire earth. That was what the prophet Isaiah meant when he said the government will rest on his shoulders. That's what the angel said to Mary. He'll rule the world, and there's going to be this huge inauguration of Jesus the Messiah who's going to rule the earth. Now, think about this. These two guys are saying, you know, it's pretty cool being an apostle and all that, wandering around and doing all these things and teaching and counseling. That's great. But, you know, when you set up this government, I just wonder, my brother and I want to know if, like, we can be the vice presidents. Would that be okay with you? And if you know the scripture very well, Matthew 20 says they even resorted to bringing their mom in. Mom says, "Yeah, I think my boys would be really good at this." Now, if you want to be crass, just call it a real thirst for power. Call it a lust for influence. Call it an attraction to authority. If you want to be subtle and you want to include yourself in it, you may put it in these kinds of terms. It's that human desire to be recognized for, you know, who I am and what I can do, my potential. It's being considered a significant part of the team and being important. And doesn't everybody want that? Whatever you want to call it, underneath every human being and the surface and their diplomacy and how they interact with people, there is a desire that we have to be important. I just want to be recognized. I want to be significant. I want to make my mark. I want to have a part in what's going on in my world. It's veiled in many ways. It's interpreted in many ways. We strategize to do it in a variety of ways. But a basic human drive we have is to be important. Now, some of it is not only excusable, some of it is God-given and understandable. But a lot of it is selfish, and a lot of it is driven by personal gain and a personal sense of becoming an important, worthy person in the eyes of other people. And distinguishing that is very hard because power and influence and authority is intoxicating. It will lure people in, and they, when they have it, they will want to have more of it. And when they don't have it, they'll want to get some. And if they've had some and had it taken away, they want to get it back. And they'll oftentimes do whatever it takes to get in the place where they feel as important as they want to feel, where they will be recognized the way they feel they ought to be recognized, that they'll have the effect and influence on people that they think they should have. And we got to be careful, because even people in the front row of the disciples of Christ can be intoxicated by a lust for power. The answer Jesus gives in this passage is worth its own sermon, and we're not going to look at that this morning. Just suffice it to say, Jesus isn't too hot on those kinds of questions, and yet godly people seem to be asking them all the time. You might be surprised to note that in Luke 22, the night before Jesus was crucified, in the upper room of all places, after 3 years of being in seminary with Jesus as your professor, there was an argument that broke out amongst the disciples the night before he was crucified. And the text says that the argument that broke out amongst the disciples was a dispute about which one of them was the greatest. Can you imagine? I can. And you probably can too. It seems like church people aren't immune to this. As a matter of fact, they seem to be more susceptible to it. I go to pastors' conferences. I talk to pastors, and they say, those church people, some of those church people are the most power-hungry people I've ever met. Then I listen to people in churches and congregants that come from other churches, and even here in our church, and say, you know, those pastors are the most power-hungry people I've ever met. And there's a lot of it going on right here in the Church of Jesus Christ that started in the first century. Remember the Apostle John, don't you? Had to rebuke a man named Diotrephes in 3 John, and he said, you know, that guy in the church is always wanting to be first. He's always promoting himself. He's never satisfied with the influence he has. He thinks he needs to be promoted and more important than other people. And he's always jockeying for position. He's always involved in power plays. He's always maneuvering for more influence and authority. We need to be very careful about this because it's so intoxicating. And it can be, in many ways, camouflaged by very culturally acceptable and even ecclesiastically acceptable methods and means, and it looks very normal and very acceptable to a lot of us. That's just the way we are. We need to be really careful because it has an insidious nature to it. It can start to corrupt our hearts and our lives and get us to focus on things that God never wants us to focus on. It can get us to do things we wouldn't normally do. It would get us to use people and circumstances in ways we would normally not do it if we weren't under this spell of wanting to have more influence and power in life. This morning, I want to warn you, if I can, from the lives of 4 individuals in 2 Samuel chapter 3. And if you have your Bibles, I want you to turn there and look at these 4 lives that you've already been introduced to, but let me reacquaint you with them real quickly. In 2 Samuel chapter 3, we have 4 people. King David, he's the up-and-coming king of Israel, anointed by Samuel many years ago, promised to be the successor to Saul. Saul is now dead, and he's reigning in Israel, but only over a part of Israel, the southern portion of Israel, the tribe of Judah. Not fully realized quite yet, but on his way. Second man I'd like to reacquaint you with was a man by the name of Ishbosheth. And Ishbosheth was Saul's son. He was one of the sons that was not killed in the battle on Mount Gilboa. He was the man that was placed in leadership in the northern part of Israel. Oh, they had lost Judah to David, but Ishbosheth was still on the throne, a very powerful man ruling over most of Israel. There was Ishbosheth's right-hand man. His name was Abner, and Abner was the commander of the army, not only in Ishbosheth's day, but he had been in Saul's day. He was a decorated, successful strategist, one to whom many people answered. There was his counterpart in David's group. His name was Joab. Joab was the commander of David's armies, leading the cry into the battlefield. He was the strategist, the most decorated person in David's band. And so we have these 4 men highlighted in 2 Samuel chapter 3. And all of them are involved in this chapter in power plays. Power plays, let me tell you, that all miserably failed. And if we look carefully at this text, we'll see that they and their quest for authority and power end up shooting themselves in the foot. They end up being counterproductive in their quest to, quote-unquote, please God and do His will because they were intoxicated with this thirst for influence, power, and authority. Let's begin with King David. We're most acquainted with him, the man after God's own heart. We've already learned he's not immune to sin. As a matter of fact, he commits some of the most common sins we see even in the church today. It takes an interesting form, though, if you look at it in verse number 2. Verse number 2, the text says that sons were born to David in Hebron. Well, okay, it's not a big alarming statement. There's nothing seemingly wrong with that. But if you look carefully in verses 2 through 5, you'll see that as these 6 sons were listed, they all have different moms. Wow, he sure was divorced a lot of times, you're saying? No, that's not how it worked in those days. You Sunday school graduates know that in the ancient Near East, all the kings of that region and in ancient times used to gather around themselves a harem. They had many wives. And that was what you did, not only to satisfy your human desires. The whole point was to have a lot of sons so that you might have heirs to the throne, that you might build a big regal family. And not only that, if you look carefully in verse number 3, some of the wives that the kings took were part of political alliances. This particular son, born of this particular wife, was the daughter of a king in Geshur to the north of Israel. And this was often the practice of the kings, to have marriage with particular women of influence and power in family so that they could build their political base. And David was involved in that. And if you have been enculturated, if you will, in the Old Testament society, you yawn your way through this and say, well, that's just the way it was in those days. But let's ask ourselves a serious question. If Jesus were on the scene, would he have been happy about this? Oh, I know God tolerated a lot of things in the Old Testament, including polygamy. But was this really God's plan? You do remember, don't you, back in Genesis chapter 1, that God didn't create Adam and Eve and Betty and Sue and Linda. You're familiar with that, right? It was Adam and Eve. That's not only a problem to the homosexual society, that's a problem to the polygamists of the Old Testament as well. It just doesn't fit. God planned marriage, and he said, here's how it works. One man, one woman. This makes a marriage, and that's the way I want it to be. And Jesus pointed that out, didn't he, in the New Testament? This is the way it was from, he says, this is a powerful Greek term, from the beginning. This was God's prototype. This was his plan. And if it wasn't enough for us to recognize that Genesis 1 taught it, all you got to do is start looking in the early part of the book of Genesis and see Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph fail miserably and see all the heartache that comes from taking on more than one wife. And some of you in marriages can just extrapolate what that might be like. Six wives? Can you imagine that? At one time? We won't go there. But think about what this must have been like. This is more than just companionship. This is political maneuvering. And every king was expected to be involved in it. And the kings were the worst violators of God's divine standard of a man and a woman. Six wives, six sons. That was the important thing for kings. Drop your eyes, if you would, down to verse number 12. If I can skip ahead in this story just a little bit, we'll talk about the defection of Abner in a minute. But Abner, the right-hand man of Ishbosheth, decides to defect. And he comes to David and he wants to make a deal. And David says, fine, I'll make a deal with you, verse 13. But one demand I've got. I want one thing from you. Verse 13, middle of the verse. Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal, the daughter of Saul, when you come to see me. And those of you who have been in our series or read the book of 1 Samuel, you remember this. This was David's first wife. David's first wife that he was given by King Saul when he was on the inns with Saul and had just killed Goliath. And things were looking bright for David. And Saul said, here's my daughter, Michal. You marry her and marry into the family. Well, of course, when things went bad between David and Saul and David split and became a fugitive, this marriage was, for all intents and purposes, it was over. And her life went on. And she had another husband. And things moved on for her and things moved on for David. Now, it wasn't that David said, you know, I got six wives, but seven would really make it perfect. You know what I'm saying? If I just had a seventh, I got an empty bedroom here, or, you know, I got space, whatever. That wasn't his thought. And it wasn't that Michal was sitting there in her home saying, you know, I just miss those days with David. He was such a wonderful husband. It was nothing like that. If you read between the lines in this particular passage, you'll recognize that David's intent in marrying Michal again was not that he would fulfill some desire he had in his life of companionship with his childhood bride. It's nothing like that. It's that if he can get back in with Saul's family, if he could marry back in, and if the people of Saul's dynasty and the tribe of Benjamin could recognize that he was part of the family again, perhaps those other 10 tribes out there in the north that don't really fully embrace me right now, perhaps they would embrace me. And so David used his marriage to do it. How do I know this wasn't just some convenient thing? Because look at the rest of this text. It says in verse 15, so Ishbosheth gave orders to have her taken away from her husband. Can you imagine? You've been married to this gal 15 years. Things are going great. Got a fine relationship. You're raising your kids together. All of a sudden, this guy in fancy clothes comes to the door and says, your wife, you know what? She's gone. We're taking her away. Guy she was married to 15 years ago wants her back. What? No way. Forget it. And that's what their husband thought. Verse 16, her husband, however, went with her, weeping behind her all the way. And finally, Abner has to say to this guy, get out of here. It's over. Forget it. David was willing to break up this family so that he could build a political alliance. What was he doing? He was using marriage as a means to leverage power. And that's just not right. Polygamy in and of itself is not right. But using relationships in general is not right. Now, I don't think many of you are tempted to become polygamous this week to get a promotion at work. That's probably not where you're living, right? So let's... is that right? Maybe you are. Maybe we need to talk about that. I got no response there. I'm thinking maybe we need to preach about that. We're not in Utah, are we? Here we are, right? I'm sorry. That was really bad, wasn't it? Forgive me. Edit that out in your mind. Here we go. Move forward. Polygamy is not your temptation, I trust. If it is, talk to me afterwards. But if it's not, though it was a cultural acceptable practice for the kings to practice polygamy to gain political alliances and gain power, it's not that way today. But it is in vogue, wouldn't you say, to use relationships in various forms to gain power? Don't you see that in our lives we can do the same thing? You know what? Let me just say categorically, that is wrong. Number one on your outline, if you're taking notes, avoid the mistake of David. Don't use relationships to gain power. Don't use relationships to gain power. Does it work? You bet it works. You learned it in junior high. So did I, right? Brenda Smith, the most beautiful eighth grader in all of the world. But you know, she was a year older than me, and you know what that's like when you're in junior high. There's no possible chance you can get her to even know that you're alive if she's one grade ahead of you. But she had a little brother, and he was in my grade. And I didn't much care for her little brother, but I thought, you know, if I could become buddies with him, I bet I could come over to his house for dinner. Who knows? I may get asked to spend the night at their house. I don't know, but I bet I can get close to her. And so, in our carnal, sinful, fleshly, depraved, fallen little minds, we learn real quick that we can use relationships to get what we want. I don't really want a relationship with him, but I'd like to have a relationship with him because it can get me what I want. We do it all the time. It happens in the corporate world every 5 minutes, doesn't it? If I can get close to that person, then I can get that. Now, there's a difference between I know someone who may be able to help and I need to get to know someone who can help me. You understand the difference, don't you? God never intended relationships to be something we use. People aren't things that we use. People are persons that we love, and that's a huge difference. Loving people is not a means to an end. It is an end in itself. You see, in our world, we've been designed to use people and love things. That's why we're such a materialistic, unrelational society. God designed it just the opposite, didn't he? He said, I want you to use things. That's okay, but you love people. As a matter of fact, he said, you're to love people as you love yourself. And if you've ever been used, and the God of equity has allowed me to be on the other end of that whole scenario many times since I was in eighth grade, where people have come to know me because they wanted something else. And you know how that feels, don't you? You feel like trash, don't you? You feel like dirt. You feel like you've been used just for something that they can gain from that relationship with you. Can you imagine being Michael, getting ripped out of your home just so that your quote-unquote husband can gain a little influence in the northern tribes of Israel? That's criminal. It's sinful and it's wrong. And when you and I are tempted to get close to people so we can get something we want, perhaps I can get to know the boss, I can get to know the manager, perhaps I can get in with that person and that may help me. Don't ever go there because God thoroughly rejects it. James calls it favoritism. We treat people differently because what we can get out of them, and he condemns it outright. Categorically, it's wrong. We don't treat people different for what we can get out of them. We love people for who they are. That's a whole different approach to relationships. Don't use people. David was into using people to gain power. There's another man here I told you about. His name is Ishbosheth. He is the ruling king in the northern tribe of Israel. If you'd look in verse number 6, jump back up to verse number 6, he's got a little problem in his kingdom. The war between the house of Saul and the house of David was going on, and Abner had been strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Now, Ishbosheth is ruling over the house of Saul, over the Benjamites, and over all the northern tribes of Israel. But he's got a guy in his kingdom, his dad's old commander, who's his commander of the armies, and he keeps strengthening his position. Now, I'm assuming now in verse number 7, what's about to transpire is part of Ishbosheth's paranoia. This guy keeps creeping up and taking more and more positions of authority and getting more and more influence in the kingdom, and I don't like that. It says in verse 7, now Saul had a concubine named Rizpah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, why did you sleep with my father's concubine? Now, the text is pretty, clear about what happens in people's lives, and it does not ever say in this passage that he did have sex with Rizpah. I mean, there's no evidence of that, but there's an accusation, and the accusation comes on the heels of the statement that Abner keeps gaining position. So here comes this accusation. Maybe it was based on nothing. Maybe it was based to quell his up-and-coming influence in the kingdom. Maybe it was that he really suspected something, and Rizpah and Abner were making eyes at each other in a meeting or something. I don't know. But Ishbosheth says, that's enough. You've been sleeping with that concubine, haven't you? And that would be a bad thing, because that would be as though he was trying to usurp the place of Saul. And that would be a bad thing. And so Ishbosheth says, what are you doing? Abner blows up. I can't believe you're accusing me of this. Verses 8 through 10 talk about his response. More on that in a minute. But look at verse 11. This sums up Ishbosheth's whole mindset. It said, Ishbosheth did not dare to say another word to Abner because, underline it, he was afraid of him. Why was he afraid? He was afraid of Abner because Abner might supplant his leadership. He could perhaps take over the influence that Ishbosheth had. Ishbosheth was paranoid. Number 2 on your outline, let me give you the prohibition, and then we'll talk about why. Second thing you and I should never do in our positions of leadership or influence, we should never be paranoid. We should not be paranoid. Now, let me tell you why we shouldn't be paranoid. We shouldn't be paranoid because paranoia reflects something about our understanding of authority in the first place. You can see, can't you, that Ishbosheth in his mind thought Abner could take my place. And so in his mind, intrinsic in that fear is that Abner really has the power to usurp his authority. Or that perhaps that he was in a position of authority because of what he had done. Keep your finger here and turn to Daniel chapter 4 with me, please. Let me show you that in Daniel chapter 4, we have a great explanation that should never be forgotten about where power and authority actually come from. And if you can get this settled in your mind, you will not be a paranoid leader. And you know what I mean by that? You finally get promoted at work, and now you're looking over your shoulder to see who's going to try and outdo you next, right? Who's coming up and trying to usurp your place of leadership. If you're paranoid, if you're afraid, if you feel threatened in your leadership, then you don't really understand where authority and leadership come from. Because they're not something intrinsic in your skills. It's not something that you create, and it is not something that other people can take away from you. It may seem that way on a human level, but it's not at all that way, because God clarifies it in this wonderful, poignant story in the life of the king of Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel chapter 4, verse number 28. You remember this story? This all happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. King Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, at the time, the most powerful, influential king Babylon had ever seen, living in the days of prosperity and great wealth. This was a wonderfully strong kingdom, and he was doing just fine. 12 months later, the text says in verse 29, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace in Babylon, and you can imagine the thoughts here, the words coming out of his mouth. Verse 30, he says, is this not the great Babylon that I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? I mean, he's feeling really good about himself right here and about all he's accomplished. Walking around going, wow, this is a really nifty place, and I am really cool for putting it all together. And I've really accomplished a lot, and it's so neat that I was able to do this just to reflect what a wonderful person I am. He's totally believing that his leadership is based on his skills and his leadership abilities. That's what he believes. And by the way, you can see in this particular statement, it's dripping with pride. When we don't understand where leadership comes from, and things are going good, we're filled with pride. When things are going bad, we're filled with paranoia. You see that? But it all relates to the same problem. We don't understand the source of authority. We don't understand leadership and how it's dispensed. Because if we do, we're neither prideful nor are we paranoid. And God's about to teach him a lesson he'll never forget. It says in verse 31, when the words were still on his lips, a voice came from heaven and said, "This is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you." Now I'm going to say, just a minute here, God. You can't take that from me. At least that's what I think I'm going to say, because if I really think I've earned it, you don't take that from me. Let's say I work all week. I work really hard. I get a paycheck at the end of the week. You come up and say, "Give me that paycheck," and you take it from me. I'm going to be ticked. I'm going to be upset. I'm going to be mad at you. And I'm going to say, "You can't take that." Why? Because I, what? Earned it. See, if you think that your position of leadership and influence in your life is something that you have earned, I understand that you may have sweated a lot, you may have worked a lot, you may have been educated a lot, you may have done a lot of things to seemingly, quote unquote, get where you are. But if you really think that your leadership is dependent on that and your influence is intrinsically bound up in that, you don't understand leadership. Because leadership, influence, authority, and power is something dispensed from God. And God can give it and God can take it away. You know that, right? Because sometimes people with everything in place, having done everything right, still don't have any authority or power or position, right? You know that. That can happen. So it's really not based on you and it's not based on others. And Ishbosheth was sitting around worried that his position might be taken away, even though he was just an interim temporary king, when in reality he should have just relaxed. Because when God was done using him as a leader in the north, it would be over and he couldn't fight to keep it if he wanted to. Well, what happens? Do you know the story? What happens to Nebuchadnezzar? He gets sent out like a lunatic, running around in the fields with no clothes on, growing long fingernails and eating grass like a cow. That's what happens. You don't believe it, you can read it later, but it's all right there in the text. And at the end of that time, in verse 34, it says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised," note these words, "the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases," underline this, "with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth." What's that mean? Every ounce of influence you have, if you have it, it's on loan. God can give it and God can take it. You know, that does two things for me. It keeps me from pride and it keeps me from Ishbosheth's problem. It keeps me from paranoia. Because there's nothing I can do intrinsically in my situation to keep it. And if someone comes and threatens it, if it's my time to give it up, in God's mind, it's going to be given up. So I just need to relax. Relax, because I know where authority comes from. And I know who can take it, and I know who can't. Men can't take it away. God can take it away. He'll use circumstances. I understand that. He'll use human beings. I understand that. But God is ultimately in charge of how much authority, power, and influence you have in this life. So number one, never use relationships to gain more power. Number two, never be paranoid when you have it. If you have authority, if you have leadership, don't be paranoid. Because it's a waste of your energy. It's much like the weather. You know what I'm saying? It's like the weather. The weather can really affect your week. If tomorrow we have this huge thunderstorm or some terrible weather this week, you know, it'd be good, I suppose, if we anticipated that, but really worrying about it can do nothing about it. We can't do anything about the weather. All we can do is report about it. We can predict it. We can think about how it's going to be, but we can't make it rain and we can't make it stop raining. It's much like that. Can't worry about the weather. I can prepare for it. I can buy an umbrella, but I can't worry about it. And I can't worry about my position of leadership, and I can't worry about my position of authority, and neither can you. It's a waste of energy. Number one, don't use relationships. Number two, don't be paranoid if you've got some influence, and we all have some. Number three, look back up to verse number six again, and let's look at this in light of Abner's character. Ishbosheth's paranoid. Abner, what's he doing? Well, something we've seen about Abner from the very beginning. When we first met Abner, we knew this was a sneaky kind of guy. We knew this guy was out to get all the power he could get. And sure enough, in verse number six, what does it say? He was out strengthening his own position in the house of Saul. Duh, that's what he does. That's the kind of guy he is. He's constantly trying to get an edge. And you know what happens. He gets accused of having sex with Rizpah, the concubine of Saul. And what's his response? Verse number eight, he's livid. He's absolutely just frustrated and angry. Abner was angry because of what Ishbosheth said. And he said, "Am I a dog's head on Judah's side?" It's a strange comment, but it's not a good one, right? What do you think I am? Notice what he says. "This very day I am," circle this word, "loyal to the house of your father Saul and to his family and friends. I haven't handed you over to David, yet now you accuse me of an offense involving this woman. I can't believe this." I love that, and I made you circle the word loyal because it's like marching into your boss's office and saying, I'm the most loyal employee you got. I'm the guy that sticks here to the end. I come early and I stay late and blah, blah, blah. And then the next sentence, look at the next verse. May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if I don't do for David what the Lord promised him on oath and transfer the kingdom from the house of Saul. That's you. And establish David's throne over all of Israel, Judah, from Dan to Beersheba, the whole entire region. What's he saying? I'm the most loyal guy in the world. I can't believe you're accusing me of this, and I'm out of here now. Forget it. Look at that. Do you see the irony and the contradiction here? He's stating that he's the most loyal guy in the world, and you and I both know he's not the most loyal guy in the whole world. What's he concerned with? Strengthening his own position wherever he's found. He set up Ishbosheth as the king in the north so he could gain positions of power. It didn't work out with Ishbosheth, and then he says what? I'm so loyal, I'm out of here. I'm not loyal to you. Really, I'm loyal to me. And some of us will do much like that and even go to people, drop your eyes down to verse 17, that we've told day after day and month after month and year after year, David's the bad guy, David's the bad guy, David's the bad guy. Why was he saying that? Because he thought David was the bad guy? No, because he thought if he could establish Ishbosheth as the king, he would be this great powerful leader. But now in verse 17, it says he goes to confer with the elders of Israel and he says, you know, for some time you've wanted to make David your king, now do it. Well, wait a minute. Why didn't you say that last week? Last week you're in here arguing with us why we shouldn't have David as our king and why Ishbosheth was the guy. Well, things have changed. I can't seem to get anywhere with Ishbosheth. I mean, we are at an impasse now. He's accusing me of things. He's paranoid. So I'm going to David's side and I'm going to make a deal with David. And in verses 12 through 15 and 16, we saw that he's made this deal with David. And now he comes and starts saying, you really should consider David as your king. It's a slimy guy, isn't it? Drop down to verse number 19. Abner also spoke to the Benjamites in person. He says, hey, these guys need a personal call. I'm really going to work the Benjamites because the Benjamites was the tribe from which Saul came, and they need a face-to-face. No fax, no emails, nothing on this, but face-to-face. I'm going to sit down and talk with them. And he starts to work them. Slimy. What's the point? Here was Abner doing whatever it takes to gain a position of power. I call it compromise. He's an opportunist. Number three on your outline. Don't be like Abner. Don't ever compromise to gain more power. And I already told you that power is intoxicating, and it gets us to do things we wouldn't normally do. And when you are in a position of power, maybe you've been promoted at work, and now you think, if I just got in with the partners, then I could really get promoted. You will start to do things that you know your Christian principles and the Word of God say you shouldn't do, but sometimes we'll compromise because we've got a taste of power. Let me quote this one for you. Read a book this week, said this, though I know intellectually how vulnerable I am to power, I am the last one to know when I succumb to its seduction. I know I'm vulnerable to power, but I'm the last one seemingly to figure out that I've succumbed to its seduction. You know who wrote that? Nixon's hatchet man, Chuck Colson. And Chuck Colson said, I got so wrapped up into this, and now that it was all exposed, we got to see all the garbage in there, but he says it was just so seducing. And I would compromise, and I would continue to compromise because I had a taste of power. And what's incredible about that book is he writes about his experience in the White House. He says, what was so interesting is that it seems that the Christians were the most susceptible to take the bait of power. He said they would come and we would bring the top clergy in. We'd bring the high-profile pastors to the White House. We'd take them out on the presidential yacht. We'd sit them in the Oval Office. We'd give them tours of the White House. And he said they would just melt. If they had any convictions, they checked them in at the door because they were so intoxicated with power. Colson says, I was intoxicated with it. People were intoxicated with it. Christians were intoxicated with it. And we would do things we wouldn't normally do because we had a taste of what it was to be influential. Be careful. Some of you are in positions of power and authority right now. And if you were to take an honest look at your life, you may see things there that you 10 years ago wouldn't believe that you would have done. But because this thing has drawn you forward, you've compromised. Number three, don't be like Abner. Do not compromise to gain more power. Don't use relationships to get it. Don't be paranoid if you've got it. And don't compromise to get more of it. It's not worth it. One more character, number four. Fourth guy that we see in this passage, beginning in verse number 22, is a guy named Joab. Joab, you remember, is the commander of David's armies. He's the top-ranking military official. He was out doing David's bidding, doing some warfare, leading the troops. Abner had just left. Verse 23 spells it out. Abner and all the soldiers had arrived. And he was told that Abner, the son of Ner, had come to the king and that the king had sent him away and that he had gone in peace. That's a huge statement. He'd gone away making a deal, a covenant, a compact, agreeing to work the elders and the Benjamites in David's favor. David's working his side of the deal. I need Michael back, because if I get Michael back on my side, the northern tribes will think that I'm ingratiating myself to them. That would be good for my political career. And everybody's involved in power moves. And Joab hears that Abner was there. Do you remember about the relationship between Joab and Abner? Last time we looked at these two guys, Joab was chasing Abner because Abner had just killed his little brother Asahel. Joab's little brother Asahel was killed by Abner, and he was chasing him. And he had him backed up against the hillside. And about that time that he could have done him in and could have killed him, Abner pulls one out of the hat and says, "Let's have a little speech here about Israelites killing Israelites." And Abner, because Joab recognized and it rung true in his heart, he realized that he should not be doing what he was about to do, escalating this warfare because of personal revenge, recognizing that Asahel had been killed by the butt of Joab's sword, not by the pointy end. He was not killed as some terrorist act from Abner's part. It was self-defense, and that was clear. And it all rung true to him. So what did Abner do? He says, "Don't kill me. We shouldn't be fighting like this." What does Joab respond with? "Okay, you're right." He blows the trumpets. He tells the troops, "We can't fight them anymore." And he lets Abner go. Now, what has changed? We're going to see him here. He's livid right now that David would make a deal with Abner. He says in verse 24, "What have you done, David? What in the world are you thinking? Abner came to you. Why did you let him go? Now he's gone. You know Abner, son of Ner. He's going to deceive you. He's here to observe your movements. He's going to find out everything you're doing. He is here on a covert operation. I can't believe you did that." We see no response from David. But Joab leaves David's presence, and he sends messengers to go grab Abner, who's heading back to the north, to work his deal with the elders. And he brings him back. David didn't know anything about this. Verse 27, Abner returns to Hebron. Joab says, hey, Abner, I hear you're making deals with David. That's great. There's just one last little issue that we need to speak about here. Can we get away privately here? Tell your soldiers just to go away because we need to talk. Joab takes him aside in the gateway as though to speak with him privately. And there, quote unquote, here's how the paper reads at least, to avenge the blood of his brother Asahel, Joab stabbed him in the stomach and he died. Now I say that tongue in cheek, that's how the papers read, because I'm thinking to myself, is that really why he killed him? I mean, let's think about this. He had a chance to kill him. He had the power to kill him. He had the opportunity to kill him. He had the motivation to kill him. The kill was fresh in his mind, and he could have killed him, but he didn't kill him. He didn't kill him on the battlefield. He didn't send troops out to covertly kill him. He didn't assassinate him. He didn't have him assassinated. He had resolved himself to the fact that it wasn't right to kill Abner because of Asahel's death. He'd already decided that. Now, what's the difference? What's the difference? What's the difference for Joab? The difference for Joab is that Abner's here now trying to work a deal with my boss. And this town ain't big enough for both of us. You're the commander of an army, and I'm the commander of an army, and you're here trying to strike deals. Forget it. You know what? I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to say it's in the name of killing my little brother, but you know what? He's already proved to us he had the chance and opportunity that he's decided not to do that. He's doing it because this guy's infringing on his position of leadership, stepping into his circle of influence, starting to mess with the power structures that Joab's used to controlling. You can't get in here and threaten my leadership. And so he takes him aside secretly under the guise of wanting to speak with him privately, jabs a dagger into his stomach, and there is Abner laying dead in this gateway. What was his power move? His power move was, you threaten my authority, I fight. Now, I trust the temptation in your life isn't to kill anybody this week to save your authority, but I tell you what, we assassinate character, don't we? We put up our dukes and we fight verbally. We gossip, we criticize, we fight back, and we defend, because that's our natural human response when you start infringing on my leadership. Whether it's in a domestic situation, maybe you're a parent trying to parent your children, you got in-laws trying to tell you how to do it, what's your response? You don't do that. Maybe you're at work and you're a manager at work and you've just had some merger with another company and here's this other guy that's your counterpart trying to tell you how to do your job. What's your response? You don't do that. That's our natural response. I've got authority. It's well mapped out. You don't infringe on that. And when you do, I fight. I fight to keep it. keep your finger here. Turn over to one more passage, Numbers chapter 12. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers chapter 12, beginning in your Bible. Let me refresh your memory about one of the greatest leaders in the Bible. I say greatest because he was certainly one of the most powerful. His name was Moses. Think about how powerful Moses was. Think about his leadership. I mean, he was throwing staves in bodies of water and they were parting and people were walking through on dry land. I mean, he was calling things out of heaven to happen. He was throwing his staff down, turning it into a snake. He was telling Yul Brynner off and no one was going to do a thing about it. You know what I'm saying? He is in charge. He is a big man on campus, and no one should be messing with Moses' leadership. No one. But they did. Numbers chapter 12, verse number 1. Miriam and Aaron. Who are they? Sunday school grads? Who are they? Brothers and sisters, right? You know how that works. Brothers and sisters here began to speak against Moses because of his Cushite wife. Right? We don't like your wife. She looks funny. She cooks funny. I don't know what it was. They didn't like his wife. She's a Cushite. We're not happy about this. And here's what they say. Hey, who is this guy anyway? Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? I mean, come on. Hasn't he also spoken through us? I mean, aren't we prophets in our own right? Aren't we leaders? Shouldn't the people recognize us? Look at this guy. Look at the bad decisions he makes. He's married this gal. She's a nut. I can't even believe. You know, I don't think he should be the sole leader in this thing. So Aaron and Miriam start to recognize that they can establish their own leadership. Now, can you imagine if you're Moses? I mean, you know, you're communing with God. You got this inside hotline to God. And all of a sudden, you got these two siblings who remember you when you were just a kid. And all of a sudden, you feel threatened. They're threatening my leadership. They're threatening my position. They're threatening my authority. They're speaking against me. They're criticizing me. They don't like the way I do my job. They don't like the decisions that I make. What's your response? What's my response? Our natural response is do this. We defend ourselves. Moses' response is going to be a lot different because of verse number 3. Here's a statement about the kind of man that Moses was. Moses was a very humble man, more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. How did he learn that? He learned that early in his career when after 40 years he tried to establish leadership his way in his time, and he learned that leadership and authority and influence come from God, not himself. And I said that. You're neither prideful nor paranoid when you realize that authority is granted by God temporarily at his bidding and by his will. That keeps you from pride or paranoia, and it also makes you a humble person. That's the opposite of pride and paranoia. You're relaxed. You're humble. He gets threatened, and he didn't do anything. He's a humble guy. Verse 4. That once the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and Miriam,
come out to the tent of meeting.
Can you imagine that? All of a sudden, you hear this voice booming from heaven saying, boys, I want to talk to you. Remember when Dad did that? Kids, you get in here right now. And so all the kids come in and report to Dad. And then it gets worse. Look at it. Three of them came out. The Lord came down in a pillar of cloud. He stood at the entrance of the tent and summoned Aaron and Miriam. And both of them stepped forward. You remember those days? Kids line up. Okay, you and you. You step forward. They're about to get a lecture. And they're about to get a spanking. And there they are. Yes, Lord. What, is there a problem? God says, verse 6, listen to my words. When there's a prophet of the Lord among you, I reveal myself to him in visions. I speak to him in dreams, all these mysterious things. But that's not the way I'm dealing with Moses. He is faithful in all my house. This is a different kind of guy. When I speak to him, I speak with him face to face, clearly not in riddles. He sees the form of the Lord, whatever that means. He's close and tight and intimate with God. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? And the anger of the Lord burned against them. And when he left, the cloud lifted up above the tent, and there stood Miriam, leprous like snow. And Aaron turned toward her and saw that she had leprosy. What did Moses do when his leadership was threatened? Did he get rolled over by his brother and sister who were frustrated with his leadership? No. How did he maintain his position of leadership and authority? His time wasn't up yet to be a leader. He was still going to be a leader. How did he defend himself? Here's the answer. He didn't have to. Whenever you see leaders that are paranoid, they're also usually people that are willing to fight when you threaten their position. And if men and women who call themselves Christians fight when they're threatened, you don't have a godly person on your hands. It is a temptation. Every time you and I are criticized, every time you and I are threatened, every time we get infringed upon, either at work or in a Christian setting, the temptation is to fight. The godly man does what? He trusts in God. I put it this way, the negative prohibition, number four on your outline, don't fight to keep your power. Don't fight to keep it. Because if it ain't your time to give it up, you know what? God ain't going to let it get given up. God is not going to let it end. God will defend you. He is our defender. He is our strength. He is our strong tower. He is our rock. He is our fortress. He is our deliverer. Are all those things true? If they're true, do I need to sit there and fight these people at work? Or can I let God deal with it? Oh, that's too spiritual. That's too passive. It doesn't work that way in the real world, Pastor Mike. You bet it does. You watch when people entrust themselves to a powerful defender, the God of the universe, who says, I'm not going to fight when my leadership is threatened. I'm going to trust God and let God establish it or let God take it away. When you do that, trust me, if you look back up in Numbers 12, I love this phrase, end of verse 2, when Moses was being criticized by Aaron and Miriam, what does the text say? Last five words, and the Lord heard this. God will listen. God will defend. God will take note. You don't have to do it. Back real quickly, 2 Samuel chapter 3. We've learned so far, David trying to build power through relationships, don't do it. We saw Ishbosheth paranoid, no need to have that attitude. We know where our power comes from. We see Abner, what? Working deals left and right, compromising, being unethical, disloyal, doing whatever it takes to gain a buck. Don't compromise to gain power. And fourthly, we see Joab defending his position. He did it under a guise that was acceptable in the minds of a lot of people, but it was wrong. Don't fight to keep it. Why do I say don't? Why is this such a negative message? Why are all these things prohibitions? They're prohibitions because when David did what he did, and Ishbosheth did what he did, and Abner did what he did, and Joab did what he did, the rest of this passage explains to us what losing strategies these were. Verses 28 through 39, the text reads, you can read it on your own, we don't have time, but if you were to look through this, you'll see that every power play lost. Ishbosheth, by virtue of the absence of the discussion here, and we'll pick it up next week, we realize that his days are numbered. No need to be worrying about the rain. It's going to rain, and I hope you have an umbrella, but there's nothing you can do. Why be paranoid? He's set up for failure. We see Abner, what, laying in a coffin. There's a funeral for him taking place here. His power move didn't work. We see Joab, who I would think, well, this guy must have turned out okay. No, the text says in verse 29, everyone recognized the wrong of his act. That David stands up and says, may the blood of his blood, that is Abner's blood, fall upon the head of Joab and upon all his father's house. May Joab's house never be without someone who has a running sore, leprosy, who leans on a crutch, who falls by the sword or lacks food. That's a wonderful statement to get from the king, right? You're being cursed. God's disfavor is upon you now. So he lost. Ishbosheth's about to lose. Abner's dead. Joab's a loser. Now he's got a curse on his whole family. What about David? Well, the question that ought to come to your mind is, why would David curse him and not punish him? If this was such a wrong thing that Joab did, why isn't he putting him in jail? Why isn't he executing him? David doesn't seem to have problems with other people. Look at the last verse, verse 39. Here's David speaking. Today he says, though I'm the anointed king, underline this, I am weak. What do you mean? All those wives, all those sons, all those heirs, all that political maneuvering. What do you mean you're weak? He is weak because his power moves didn't result in any power in this situation. He said, these sons of Zeruiah, that's in this case Joab he's referring to, too strong for me. I can't manage them. I can't handle them. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil deeds. That's a cop-out. That's a compromise. That's a wimpy move. I know that because later in the book of 2 Samuel, on his deathbed, David ends up telling his son Solomon, you know, Joab did a really bad thing. Would you kill him for me? That's what I should have done. So what happens? No one's better for any of the power moves. They're all losers. David, Ishbosheth, Abner, Joab, all that maneuvering, and God's disapproval on all of them. Doesn't work. What's the upshot? Relax. God establishes. God moves people up. He exalts people. He puts people down. He's in charge. Relax. May sound too simplistic for you, but the intoxicating lure of influence will kill us. There was a young man named Joseph who was doing very well in Bible school. He did so well in Bible school, he was given a full-ride scholarship to go to seminary. While in seminary, everyone was impressed with his work. He worked very hard and was very accomplished. Actually, while he was in seminary and everyone was impressed with his theology, something slowly was happening to his heart. Under the intoxication and the lure for influence and power, he continued to be internally corrupted. Eventually, it surfaced. People started to see it. He was drawn more and more to the speakers who would talk about influence and power and authority. He couldn't leave the topic. He wanted to be noticed. He wanted to be important. He wanted to make a name for himself. So in time, the seminary saw this and saw so much of it, they kicked him out of the seminary. About the time they kicked him out of the seminary, his new friends had coined a name for him. They called him the Man of Steel because he was the most tenacious, self-promoting person they'd ever met. In time, Joseph succeeded in doing what he wanted. He actually did make a name for himself. He was so successful at making a name for himself that his name appears in every modern history book you have on your shelf. His name appears in every encyclopedia you have. If you read that encyclopedia this afternoon, you should read about his upbringing in a church every Sunday, sitting there just like you are today. Going to church in Georgia, and not the Georgia in the Bible Belt, getting a scholarship to a seminary, the theological seminary in Russia, getting acquainted with Lenin, and Lenin actually saying in his memoirs that Joseph was one of the most hard-headed, tenacious, aggressive, and rude people he'd ever met. He ended up taking Lenin's place. And those encyclopedias should read that Joseph Stalin was the bloodiest, most paranoid, cruelest, most abusive dictator and despot the modern world has ever seen. But it all started in church. Satan was out to sow the seeds of power and influence of a guy studying for the ministry. You think we're immune? We're not immune. It might be that in our quest to follow the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, perhaps we're even more susceptible to it. The Bible says we've got an enemy and he prowls around like a roaring lion seeking someone to devour. And you may think your pictures of a devoured person is something completely different than Satan's plan, because his plan sometimes is to promote those people, to make them powerful and strong and influential. Be careful. Don't become intoxicated with power. Avoid the power plays. Relax, and God will do the rest. Let's pray. Got an important topic for us in a day of superheroes and celebrities and stars. We need to be really careful that Satan doesn't lure us into this whole influence, power, authority trip. God, I pray this message would be memorable because it would help us, I think, if we could just remember the mistakes of David and Ishbosheth, Abner and Joab. We would learn that these kinds of power moves don't work, wanting to get to know someone so we can get an advancement in our place of work, using people, compromising, being paranoid, defending ourselves. God, help us. Help us to trust in you, because we know that it is very fragile, this thing called influence. We have it one day. We may not have it the next. God, we rely on you. We trust in you. We want to renew our confidence in you. And help us to guard our hearts and our lives so that Satan, looking at this congregation, never finds someone to work with. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.